Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When we listen on Audible, we are unconfined, free to travel the worlds inside our minds, where time moves faster, stops, rewinds. So let's walk and dance a mile in other shoes. Whatever's next is ours to choose. There's more to imagine when we listen. Audiobooks, podcasts, originals. Start listening now at Audible.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 29th of May, these are our main stories. We'll have the latest from Ukraine after Kyiv suffers heavy daytime bombardments. New laws in Uganda mean LGBT people could face the death penalty. Pro-democracy campaigners go on trial in Hong Kong. And analysis from Turkey after Recep Tayyip Erdogan secures 5 more years in power. Also in this podcast...
At one level, Messi and Ronaldo are billboards for brand Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabian ambitions. But I think in many ways, they're also legacy signings as well.
As Saudi Arabia makes waves in the world of football, we look at what's next for the game there and why some people are not happy about it. In Kyiv, as in other Ukrainian cities, missile strikes are not unusual, but the number and frequency of these attacks seems to be increasing. And now Kyiv suffered a daytime barrage instead of the usual nighttime ones. James Landell is in Kyiv and was forced into a bunker during the strikes and then went to one of the sites which had been damaged.
The air raid is over. Normal life is beginning to resume. I'm at a spot outside the centre of town where some of the debris for the missiles landed. In all, the authorities here say that 11 ballistic and cruise missiles were launched to the capital. All of them were destroyed by air defences. But of course, when that happens, debris falls. And where I am, a large chunk of flaming missile landed in the middle of the road. As far as we can tell, we think nobody was hurt because it missed a car by an absolute whisker. But just from where I am now, we're only, a few yards away from a petrol station. And so if that flaming missile had landed on the petrol station, the consequences could have been quite different. That is a mark of the lottery that the people of Kyiv are having to listen to and live with at the moment. But, and as you say, unusual for this to be a daylight air raid. And so I think another indication of Russia wanting to ratchet up the pressure on Ukraine ahead of any potential counteroffensive.
It's hard to understand. I mean, I get that sense they're doing it ahead of the counteroffensive, yet apart from that military airfield, still striking civilian targets. Is this just by way of warning to Kyiv? This is what will happen if you attack us?
I think they're doing both. As you say, Russians are targeting military targets, and overnight, of the 75 missiles and drones that were targeted, 8 were not destroyed by air defences, and clearly some of them have landed on military targets in the west where ammunition and fuel depots and things like that have been struck. But as you say, if you strike the centre of Kyiv in the middle of the day, forcing children to run from their schools to shelters, forcing commuters and workers to have to cram into the underground, clearly there is a much greater risk of civilians being caught up. And certainly the military authorities here claim this is a deliberate tactic to impose psychological pressure on the people of Kyiv. I have to say, from my own experience, having spent much of this week and the weekend talking to people about this kind of thing, the resilience is still pretty strong. It doesn't seem to be having an impact in terms of making people feel disheartened. Actually, it only fuels their determination to support this war and remove Russian forces from their soil.
As well as the strikes on Kyiv and other cities in Ukraine, there have also been strikes within Russia. Sergei Goryashko from the BBC's Russian service told me more about what's happening.
some villages bordering with Ukraine were under shelling in Belgorod. It was not the biggest attack as the one which has happened like a couple of weeks ago in the 22nd of May, where an insurgent group entered Russian territory. The life actually continues in Belgorod and in the region of Belgorod, but it doesn't look normal at all. Residents are always reminded on the ongoing fighting of by bomb shelter signs, by the counter-missile systems working, by posters with instructions of what to do in case of an artillery attack, and, of course, by military recruitment advertisements. The governor of Belgorod region, Vyacheslav Gladkov, has just came up today with quite a controversial statement that first Russia should declare the state of war because the Belgorod region is living now in a state of war, whether you like it or not, as he quote, he said that. And he also told that the only thing which could help Belgorod to stop the shelling is the annexation of Kharkiv region.
Can I just get it straight? Do most people in Russia know about these attacks? Are they being widely reported that, you know, there have been successful incursions across the border?
Well, they are reported, but maybe we could say that they are a little bit underreported on the state media because, in fact, this has never happened yet in Russian history before Putin started this so-called special military operation. And in this case, of course, this is a clear casus belli for starting a war, but still, they are reported, but it's like something which is normal for a state which is conducting a special military operation. That is how it sounds from the news lines.
Sergei Goryashko, and before that, we heard from James Landale. It was always tough being gay, lesbian or transgender in Uganda. Severe punishments have been meted out to people convicted under Uganda's anti-gay laws, not to mention mob violence directed at homosexual people, which has sometimes been fatal. But now, Uganda's LGBT laws have been made even harsher. President Yoweri Museveni has signed a bill which allows for a death sentence to be passed for what it calls aggravated homosexuality. This includes having sex while knowing you're HIV positive. There's also a 20-year sentence for promoting homosexuality. But the new law will change life for all LGBT people, lives which campaigner Pap de Dolovi Kawagla says has become increasingly tough anyway, with some facing eviction from their homes.
Queer people are being thrown out, backed up by law. They do not have housing anymore. They don't have shelter. There is no safety whatsoever. That's what I can say about that. Queer people can't get medication, queer people can't get education, and at the moment there is a lot of mob justice that is happening, beating people up, killing people. You know, many people can't really handle that, so before the government kills you, people are killing themselves.
So a tough situation already for LGBT people in Uganda. The BBC's correspondent there, Patience Atuhaire, told me how the new law makes life tougher.
What's now being defined as the offence of homosexuality is limited to sexual acts. The environment is likely to change because people react to government decisions and decisions out of parliament. In other words, if people were quietly living as gay, they now would be afraid that their lives might change because the Speaker of Parliament in her tweet this morning called on the police to enforce the law as soon as possible. So the situation for people who identify as sexual minorities is likely to change.
Uganda has a lot of problems, economic troubles, ethnic division, fighting across the border, which often Uganda gets dragged into. Can you explain why it is that in the midst of all these other challenges, the issue of homosexuality seems to get people so exercised and get so much attention?
It gets attention and it has always been such a divisive issue. Now, in this phase and the process of passing this new law, the supporters and the drafters of the bill emphasize the issue of protecting the traditional family values, protecting children from abuse by people who identify as sexual minorities. And this got parents worried, it got people excited, it got people arguing in support of the law because there's this belief that hasn't been proven that people who identify as sexual minorities are predators, that they are taking advantage of children and recruiting them. And that is why, despite all the other concerns and problems the country has, this issue tends to get people very excited, ordinary people angry as well.
Patience Atuhaire. To Hong Kong now, where 13 people have gone on trial over the pro-democracy protests there in 2019. They face charges from unlawful entry to rioting and criminal damage. Nobody denies there was a full-scale assault on the Hong Kong Legislative Building, with windows smashed and walls graffitied. But the response from China was a crackdown on the entire pro-democracy movement. Our correspondent in Hong Kong, Martin Yip, described how surprisingly upbeat defendants turned up at the court.
We saw these defendants arriving this morning with one in particular, Althea Xun, in big smile, hugging with her friends and all sorts of things before going in. It seems like she's so prepared to plead guilty, and she did, together with another six defendants. So seven of them pleaded guilty and five pleaded not guilty. That includes a celebrity, Gregory Wong. He's a pretty popular TV celebrity here. But they may have a little bit more things to do before they can actually start doing opening statements and all that, because there's one more defendant who that his lawyers are arguing if he's mentally fit to stand trial. So once all these things got set, we can expect a full trial for 44 days to go on.
In mainland China, I know that criminal trials have a conviction rate of more than 99%. Is it the same in Hong Kong? Do these people have effectively no chance of being acquitted?
I think people are somehow expecting that they would be found guilty in trials like these, but still in Hong Kong's court, there are chances of them being found not guilty in some cases. So it's really a wait and see. For these 44 days, we'll have to see how many of them will be found guilty. Although it's pretty sure that for those who plead the guilty, they will just have to wait for their sentence to be laid down.
And what kind of sentence is expected?
So the charge itself could bear up to 10 years in jail, but it's tried in a district court, so the court can only give them in a maximum jail term of 7 years.
That attack on the Hong Kong legislature, it was in some ways the sort of last gasp of the mass protest movement for democracy, with, I think it was 10,000 people arrested altogether. Where is that democracy movement now in Hong Kong? Has it been completely snuffed out?
You can pretty much put it that way, because we have not been seeing any meaningful protests since the introduction of the national security law by Beijing on the 30th of June 2020. There are only very small-scale protests that you have to name tag yourself along the way. Only one of such kind has happened in a local community, and there are attempts to host rallies on the Labor Day, the 1st of May, and they all got called off. So it's really like there are no chance for anyone to go out in protesting scale for the time being.
Martin Yip. There's been more fallout from a scandal in Australia over the leaking of confidential government tax plans by the accounting giant PwC. The firm's now suspended nine directors after emails showed that PwC's Australian operation had misused the information to win new business. Phil Mercer reports.
For years, confidential information about Australian federal tax laws allowed PricewaterhouseCoopers to tailor its advice to clients earning millions of dollars. The company has acknowledged an overly aggressive pursuit of profit. The Australian government is the consulting firm's biggest customer. PwC's acting chief executive, Kristin Stubbins, has apologised for betraying the trust placed in us. A criminal investigation is underway.
Phil Mercer reporting. Imran Khan's political fortunes have been rather badly knocked lately. Pakistan's opposition leader and former prime minister did manage to rouse tens of thousands to take part in protests against efforts to arrest him. But many senior figures in his PTI party have resigned or been taken into custody. He told the BBC's Caroline Davies the whole political system in Pakistan was under threat.
The entire party is virtually being put into jail, all the senior leadership. It doesn't happen in a democracy. This doesn't happen when there's rule of law. So what you're saying...
You put some of your opposition into prison as well.
You can't even compare what's going on.
You use the same system that they're using
Absolutely
now.
Absolutely not. Look, 95% of the cases against the opposition were before our time. We inherited them.
You said that you want to have these discussions, you want to have negotiations. Your position now is substantially weaker than it was a month ago. So what is it that you are going to offer that you can put on the table now that you didn't put on a table a month ago?
Look, the moment my position will be weak is when I lose my vote bank. A political party weakens when it starts, its vote bank starts shrinking. I mean, you think it's a big crisis for me? I don't. The fact that the country is now receded from democracy, we are basically facing a martial law.
But what are you offering?
Talks so that I can understand the mindset. I've told them, you convince me what is best for Pakistan, I'll agree with you.
Your party have said Imran Khan is our red line. They've said that for months. What does that mean?
What it means is that the sort of things that have happened in this country where there's no rule of law and they've been picking up people and that there's all these cases against me, that if they think they'll sit quietly and do nothing, if they shove me in jail, there would be a reaction.
But you know, that does sound to many like a threat.
Well, I didn't make the threat. It's the workers and the party members.
You can't separate yourself off because you are the party.
So what am I supposed to say then? If they say Imran is my red line, I'll say, no, I'm not their red line. What should I say?
I was out in Islamabad with people who were speaking passionately about supporting you, but were also using slingshots, throwing stones, holding very large sticks against the police. There are videos of your supporters who were part of the crowd, part of the group, that were burning down military buildings.
It's not true.
Imran Khan talking to our correspondent Caroline Davies and sounding rather defiant. So I asked Caroline Davies how he seemed to remain so positive with so many forces in Pakistan now ranged against him.
I've yet to speak to Mr. Khan when he hasn't been defiant. So I suppose it's not a surprise that even now when he feels like he's backed into a corner, that he's still using that sort of language. And you speak to some of his supporters and they say, no, this is the moment when he's often at his best, when his true cricketing grit comes through and he's able to pull himself out of a difficult corner. But it's very difficult to see how Mr. Khan is going to pull himself out of this particular corner with dozens of his key party leadership, who not only provide him with advice and guidance and strategy, but also quite crucially votes in areas of the country where that is really important. Many of those have now left the party altogether, when many thousands of his supporters are also still in prison, and when he's got this potential threat of still being arrested hanging over him, which he very much believes is something that could happen at any point as well. So very difficult to say how Mr. Khan is going to be able to turn this round.
One simple question, is this just about protecting himself from arrest, or does he seriously hope to be Prime Minister again?
I think that he still hopes that he's got some sort of political future and that he still continues to say he believes in the party. But at this stage, I think Imran Khan is making sure that he's still got any form of relevance.
Caroline Davies. There are so many people climbing Mount Everest these days, you sometimes see a queue waiting to get to the summit. It's perhaps hard to remember that it's only 70 years since the first people conquered the mountain. The New Zealander Edmund Hillary and Nepalese Sherpa Tenzing Norgay arrived at the top on the morning of May 29th, 1953. Since then, all kinds of records have been broken. The fastest ascent, the most ascents, ascent by people living with disabilities. Lydia Punamu Brady is a New Zealand mountaineer. And in 1988, she became the first woman to get to the top without carrying an oxygen supply. She says Everest is no longer a challenge dominated by male mountaineers.
I've been a mountain guide, and I'm super proud of being a mountain guide. I've guided Everest more than any other woman has guided it at the moment. And it's great because the job for a woman is opening up and lots of groovy young female guides are coming on. And as a guide, you're there with a passion and a love for the beauty of this mountain. It's amazing to be on this highest point of the world.
So, more women on Everest, more climbers in general, but something else has changed, the climate. Our reporter Naveen Singhadkar explained how global warming has made life even more difficult for those who want to reach the top.
The basic thing is the climb, as you know, starts with this glacier called Khumbu Glacier. And Khumbu Glacier, as with any other glaciers in the world, it's thinning, it's retreating, and The main thing is it's being destabilized. That's why there's this immense risk. And then you know that there is this Khumbu ice fall. It's a particular stretch of that glacier that kind of makes a sudden fall. That is the trickiest part. That's where many climbers get killed. Only last month, three Sherpa support staff were killed because of an avalanche. And it's not just about glaciers then, but then, you know, the mountain is about what? Snowpacks, ice fields, seracs, rocks. They're all being changed. So mountaineers tell me there's many rock falls nowadays. No warnings, nothing. And then bare rocks, very difficult to climb.
I know that the average number of people being killed on the mountain each year has been rising. Now hundreds of people have died, but it doesn't seem they're put off by the kinds of changes you're describing.
Still, you see record number of people going up. For example, this year, the government issued 478 permits. That's a record. And then just today, we reported this story because of this risk. The government had planned to move. Last year, only the government had told us that they would move the base camp to lower locations. But now it looks like they have kind of shelved that plan because of opposition from the members of Sherpa community and also other operators. So, yeah, it's a mixed picture. Risk growing, but still climbers are growing.
Naveen Singh Katka. Still to come on this podcast.
There isn't anything else that we can do. We're pretty hopeless in any other situation.
A musical blast from the past, having a renaissance in the present as the 70-somethings of Sparks retake the music scene. It says it all that among the first people to congratulate Recep Tayyip Erdogan were the President of the United States, Joseph Biden, and the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, both are desperately keen to keep Mr. Erdogan on side. And his victory in the weekend's presidential election means he can continue to play a pivotal international role, not to mention cementing his grip on power at home. Many had predicted that after 20 years in power, this contest would see the president unseated. But a second round of voting saw Mr. Erdogan win by a convincing margin, and his supporters celebrated well into the night.
We've been here before and we'll always be here. This is our home. May God take 20 years from my life and give it to my president.
The victory is ours. How happy it is for us. Bye-bye, Mr. Kemal. Thank God Islam has won.
President Erdogan told his cheering supporters that the entire nation of 85 million won. But what went wrong for the opposition? A question I put to our correspondent in Istanbul, Anna Foster.
The opposition campaign had a shaky start just before they announced Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu as their candidate. They had what they called the Table of Six. It was six different opposition parties who came together and put forward a single candidate with the ultimate goal of unseating Mr. Erdogan. Even the HDP, the Kurdish party, declined to put forward their own candidate. They said that they would support him as well. And it seemed for a time that they had the following wind, that they had the best chance in years of actually unseating Mr. Erdogan. But as you say, 2 weeks ago in that first round of voting, President Erdogan was very, very close. One man needed to reach more than 50% in order to be elected, and he fell just short, 49.5. But I think at that point, you could argue that the wheels came off the opposition campaign. There was this sharp change of course. They started talking about immigration, which really, I think, for many people felt like a stark contrast to the very kindly, democratic, free speech endorsing Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu that they'd seen up until that point. And of course, some of the figures that we saw yesterday, the turnout was lower. There's some suggestion that that was because people in Kurdish majority areas, having seen this swing to the right from Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu, decided to withdraw their support in the second round. But I think a lot of opposition supporters this morning are feeling like this was a missed opportunity. They feel that this was their best chance in years to replace their president, and it didn't happen.
President Erdogan, I saw, says that he wants to unite the country now that he's won. But is that actually possible with opinions so polarised, the issue of the Kurds continually unresolved, a united Turkey?
He said that he wanted, as you said, didn't he, to be a president for all of Turkey, for everybody in this country. But in that same speech, you know, he talked about the Kurds disparagingly. He talked about the LGBTQ population disparagingly, and that doesn't really seem like a way to draw people together, does it? And the question is really whether or not he meant that or whether it was just a sop to the opposition, because he will take this as a ringing endorsement of those authoritarian policies that he's brought in, that executive presidency that has really taken Turkey closer and closer to one-man rule. He will argue that people had a choice and they chose him, and therefore his direction of travel is the one that this country should be taking.
Anna Foster in Istanbul. The week-long ceasefire in Sudan is due to come to an end tonight. Not that many people there are likely to notice. Fighting has carried on despite their supposed truce, though both sides have talked about the possibility of an extension. One of the worst affected areas is Darfur in the west of Sudan. Ethnic fighting there 20 years ago cost perhaps several hundred thousand lives. And one of the militias linked to much of the killing back then has strong links to one of the warring parties in today's violence. Refugees have been driven across the border from Darfur into Chad, as Barbara Plett-Usher reports.
In late April, militias began attacking the town of El Janina in West Darfur. Video filmed on a mobile phone shows them waving guns, running and shouting. Justine Musique Piquemal works for the French NGO Solidarité Internationale. She's now waiting in Chad with plans to cross the border into Darfur as soon as she can. It's dangerous because heavy fighting has continued in the region despite the ceasefire.
We need to send humanitarian goods as soon as we can because what we are going to find, I think, it will be dead body everywhere in Janina and no water, no latrines and no food.
Justine has been able to maintain sporadic communication with her people on the ground, but it's very difficult to get access or information. So we worked with our BBC Verify colleagues to assess images and videos that could tell the story.
You can see temporary structures where people who have been displaced have settled over there.
This is Peter Mwai. He's been studying satellite photos that show the destruction in El Janina over several weeks.
This is from late April. You can see all these patches of areas that have been burnt down. All these structures where people were staying in, they have all disappeared.
And then we have an image from the middle of May, I think.
Yes, now the destruction has spread. It's quite a huge area to be visible in satellite images.
To the south is Niala, Darfur's biggest city. Their satellite images show that part of the market has also been blackened by fire. We got video of the destruction from a resident. The phone connections are so bad we couldn't make calls. So we texted a local journalist, Essa Dafalla, with questions. And he sent us this reply.
The RSF stormed the city with dozens of pickup trucks mounted with guns. NGO offices and shops were looted.
So who is doing all this burning and looting and killing? Local residents say that in Niala, it's the RSF, or the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, which is fighting the army. It does have its roots in Darfur. But in that video we started with, militias on the rampage in El Janina, the fighters are not wearing uniforms. The RSF leader, General Hamdan Daglo, has called for calm. A message to our people in the city of El Janina, he says, reject regionalism and tribalism and stop fighting among yourselves now. Especially in El Janina, the lines are blurred. There are different community militias, including fighters from Arab tribes known as the Janjaweed, and that's the base from which the RSF was formed.
There are force accused by the United States of participating in genocide.
20 years ago in Darfur, the Janjaweed were mobilized to crush a rebellion by non-Arab tribes. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. The current battles have reignited those communal tensions. Konstantina Sikakos is a project manager for the medical charity organization Doctors Without Borders. Its hospital in El Janina was looted, but he's not sure by whom.
The problem is that you start having intercommunal fights on the ground that you cannot verify when the military party starts and when the communal fight begins. It needs to stop because we are in the very peak of the cliff before we actually start declining.
A war of all against all, multiple groups fighting one another, could spread to other regions of the country and beyond.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Now, is it a missile or is it simply the launch of a satellite? North Korea has made it clear it intends to fire something into the sky at some point in the next 2 weeks or so. But its insistence that this is just a satellite launch hasn't convinced everyone. In the last few months, the Hermit Nation has carried out a series of missile and weapons tests. This one has prompted Japan to put its missile defense system on high alert. So why is this missile launch causing so much concern? Our correspondent in Seoul, Jean McKenzie, says it is partly about the satellite that the missile is carrying.
It is pretty clear that North Korea wants to and is planning to launch a spy satellite rather than just a missile. It has been working on this spy satellite for some time. Kim Jong-un put this on his military wish list more than 2 years ago. And for the last month, he has been saying that, you know, preparations for this satellite are nearly complete and that the launch is ready. He wants a spy satellite in space. It would be his first spy satellite in space because it would give him essentially eyes from the sky over his enemies, so over South Korea and the US. So it would give him a real strategic advantage that he doesn't have at the moment. It would mean that he could not only, you know, spot an incoming attack, but he would be able to map out targets and plot his own attacks.
Just thinking about the launch itself, North Korea has had a troubled track record of launching these missiles, some of them having to be blown up in flight or crashing into the sea. Are they confident about this one?
Yeah, we have to see if this launch is, of course, going to be successful. The North has launched two satellites in the past, and neither of them appear to have worked. We think they're dead satellites. And also, it's important to note that one spy satellite in space wouldn't even be enough for North Korea to be able to constantly monitor its enemies. So for that, you need a network of satellites. But it would be a significant development because it would show that it certainly has the technology to be able to keep launching these. Now, you mentioned the danger, and of course, we've had that warning from Japan here today that it's going to shoot down the missile if it needs to. So this is because the satellite would be launched in a rocket. Now, it's possible that that rocket may cross over Japanese territory. So that could pose a risk to Japan because you might have things like falling debris. So that's the point at which Japan says, look, if we think that this threatens our territory, we will not hesitate to shoot that down. Whether it will be able to shoot it down is another question.
Jean McKenzie. Cristiano Ronaldo is already there. And out Lionel Messi could be the next superstar to join Saudi Arabia's ambitious football league. Speculations also mounting of a potential Saudi-led World Cup bid. The kingdom's influence on the game is certainly growing, but not without opposition. This is a country where democracy is still not even countenanced and where people are often beheaded after trials which critics say are a sham. The suggestion is that Saudi Arabia is using football in an attempt to clean up its image. Here's our sports news correspondent, Alex Capstick.
Saudi Arabia's thrilling victory against Argentina, one of the standout results of the World Cup. A monumental moment for the tens of thousands of fans who poured across the Qatari border last November.
Always winner when we play. Yes. From our heart,
yes,
we will win. You know that? And you believe it? Yeah.
The euphoria was short-lived. Saudi lost their next two games and failed to qualify from their group. But that success over Argentina, the eventual world champions, laid down a marker. Football in Saudi Arabia was on the rise.
It showcases that, you know, everything that we've been developing in the kingdom and spending for the federations, and especially the football federation, that paid off.
The country's sports minister, Prince Abdulaziz bin Turki Al Faisal, speaking to us during the World Cup in Qatar, and the Saudis would soon spring another surprise.
Well, for me, it's a pleasure to be here.
Cristiano Ronaldo shocked many when he signed for the Riyadh-based club Al Nassr. And now Lionel Messi could become the next member of football's royalty to join the Saudi Pro League.
I am Simon Chadwick, Professor of Sport and Geopolitical Economy at Schema Business School in Paris.
Simon Chadwick is an expert on the geopolitics of sport. He says figures like Ronaldo and Messi are a crucial part of a carefully planned strategy.
At one level, Messi and Ronaldo are billboards for brand Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabian ambitions. But I think in many ways, they're also legacy signings as well. So if they can inspire the next generation of Saudi Arabian youngsters either to play or to watch, to engage with the sport, then their signings will be worth it for that reason.
This focus on sport, and it's not just football, has its critics. Lina Al-Hathloul is a Saudi activist. She's based in Belgium and works for an independent NGO which promotes and defends human rights. Her sister, Lujain, who led the campaign for women to drive in Saudi, spent nearly 3 years in jail. She was released, but is subject to a travel ban.
It basically covers up the situation. It gives a false impression of what is happening in the country. People will think of Messi or Ronaldo when thinking of Saudi Arabia rather than thinking of my sister Lujain.
Saudi activist Lina Al-Hathloul, heading that report by Alex Capstick. Pop stars tend to have their greatest success while they're young. Indeed, when it came to the band Sparks, there were plenty ready to dismiss them as one hit or maybe two hit wonders. And yet, it's now nearly half a century since the release of their first chart topper, This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us. And Sparks are playing their biggest world tour yet. So why do they keep going? Well, the band are currently in London, where they told our arts correspondent David Sillitoe the answer's quite simple. They don't know how to do anything else.
Sparks, the Mail Brothers. Russell, the voice. Ron, the toothbrush moustache and the slightly unnerving looks to camera.
I kind of wasn't self-aware enough about the effect of the moustache.
The facial hair is now a bit less Chaplin-esque than it was in the 70s, but he's still writing the songs. This is all ain't big enough for the both of us. And 50 years after writing This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, they're suddenly drawing the biggest crowds of their career.
You're selling out not one, but two nights at the Royal Albert Hall.
Yes.
you sound even more surprised than we are. You know, we don't take it for granted.
We were huge Anglophiles when we were growing up, you know, and getting our musical inspiration. And part of all of that was like, oh, my God, it's the Royal Albert Hall.
They're also playing the Hollywood Bowl. There's been a collaboration with Franz Ferdinand, a musical at the Cannes Film Festival, an award-winning documentary.
We are Sparks.
Dude. And their latest video features a performance from Cate Blanchett. The girl is flying in her latte, yeah. It's all been a bit unexpected.
There isn't anything else that we can do. We're pretty hopeless in any other situation. So we kept plowing on.
Their ages are, like most personal details about them, a bit of a mystery. But one thing is clear. They're enjoying a glorious Indian pop summer in what is probably their mid to late 70s.
David Sillitoe. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Javed Galiani and the producer was Steph Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss, and until next time, goodbye.